Welcome to New Books in Science Fiction. I'm Rob Wolf, your host. In today's episode, I am speaking with Elliot Fintichel, author of Zen City, which is his second book. Elliot is also a performance artist, a professional mime who has been a Nebula Award nominee, and he's also received various fellowships, including one from the National Endowment for the Arts for his solo performance work. Elliot, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
I can only imagine that you've had a fascinating career trajectory, and I'm super curious to hear how you got into performing and how you evolved from being a mime, a solo performance artist, into writing science fiction.
Well, it's funny. It really is all connected because I was driven by dire spiritual necessity, you might say, for which read depression, anxiety, angst, and so on, to join a Zen center up in Rochester, New York. There was a big Zen center there.
And that's where you're from, right? Rochester?
Right, my hometown, right across the street from where I was living. I saw this parade always in the pre-dawn hours of these people in these dun brown clothes going in and coming out. And when I went to examine what was going on, I found out that they were Zen students. There was a guy named Philip Kaplow there, who's kind of famous in the Zen world for having written a book called Three Pillars of Zen. And so I went to one of his talks, I was, can I say this without suffering prosecution, was taking LSD in those days.
Statute of limitations is worn out, but I'm not a lawyer, I don't know.
Philip Kaplow was giving a talk that was entitled, I think, Zen and Psychedelics or something like that. So just like Paul on his way to stone the Christians, I was going to Philip Kaplow's lecture in order to give him a hard time and tell him all the things he didn't understand about acid. I was very disappointed that he didn't say anything I could disagree with. And I told him so as he went up the stairway away from the lecture hall. And he looked out at me and half smiled, the way they do, and said, come back and try again.
And what year, what year was this?
Let's see, that would have been around 1973. And eventually I became a member, a zealot, a true believer at the Zen Center of Rochester, and worked for, was sitting day and night, honestly, many, many, many hours a day, and living in a kind of a Zen ghetto where you know, eight people lived together in an apartment and just did menial labor.
You moved from across the street from your apartment into a Zen apartment?
Yeah, right. Eventually, I did. Yeah, and we were all we wanted to do was to sit on our cushions and stare at mop boards and do Zen work pretty much 24/7. But the thing is that in December came a retreat every year that was the hardest one. In those days, there were people in their robes staring at the wall, and someone would walk up and down the aisles with a stick and would hit people on the shoulders to keep them awake or to encourage them. Mostly, I mean, people weren't really hurt by it, except that I with the soft skin on my shoulders, often had to have moleskin put on to protect me. But after that December session, which was so hard, December retreat, there was always a New Year's celebration where people just let loose. And I was kind of the master ceremonies of that. And I got a reputation as a kind of stand-up comedian. And when a guy came from New York who had been an actor and a mime and had a mime studio in New York, Michael Henry was his name, now a Zen priest in Denver, he opened up a mime studio and invited me to be part of it. So there I was, directly from the world of Zen into the world of mime and performance. And it was my job to, under a CEDIC grant, a grant from the United States government in New York State, to do children's theater outreach. I wrote children's plays and did performances for children and studied mime and mask work and puppetry and related arts. So out of Zen came everything, came my career, the way I made a living.
You've gone full circle. Your current book is mm-hmm. called Zen City, and as
right.
listeners will gather as the discussion continues, it draws heavily on your experience, obviously, with Zen.
That's right. Yeah, it does.
At some point, you started also writing science fiction.
Yeah, and that came because the history of Zen has always been very tumultuous, and students break with teachers and start new lineages, and they decry each other's traditions, and that happened in Rochester as well. The Rochester Zen Center bifurcated, and I went off with one branch, and many people became disillusioned, and in the course of that chaos, I learned of a teacher in California, whom I subsequently visited, who was on this fantastic, beautiful hill, Sonoma Mountain. There was this grand Zen center on this grand mountain, a very beautiful place to be. And eventually, I moved there to the Zen center on Sonoma Mountain in California with my wife and small child at that time. And then, being in California, severed from all my contacts for performance art and mime and so on, desperate to find some way of making a living while I was at that Zen center, I did possibly the stupidest thing that a person could do in retrospect. I mean, you're a mime, right? And you try, and mime doesn't work anymore. So what do you do to make a living? Become a writer, of course. And that's what I thought to do. And miraculous to tell, it worked. I started writing science fiction stories and sending them out and collecting rejection slips, hundreds, thousands. I used to paper my wall with them until after about a year, I started having stories accepted by Asimov's and Science Fiction Age and other science fiction magazines.
And did that give you enough money to actually live on?
It gave me enough to be able to make the transition to California while I reestablished contacts for doing children's shows and other things, and some teaching. I started teaching at where I still teach, actually, at the Santa Rosa Junior College, movement and improvisation for theater.
But obviously, you must have been interested in science fiction. It's not like someone turns to that and says, wait, I need a fast and easy way to make a little money. let me start trying to get some short stories published.
Right. Yeah. Well, I always loved science fiction. It's true. I was a big fan of, let's see, Alfred Bester, Theodore Sturgeon, Heinlein, of course, you know.
Sure.
Strangers in the Strange Land was like a Bible for us back in the day.
Yeah, those are the stalwart classics. Absolutely.
And Philip K. Dick, of course, by the way, who lived not far from where I live now. I've run across two or three women just walking down the streets in Santa Rosa and Sonoma, who told me that they were his mistress and lived with him.
Wow. These were different women, I gather.
Different women, yes.
All walking down the same street.
No, different streets. I wonder if they would have recognized each other. That would have been a story.
So then ever since you've integrated these two things, science fiction writing and mime and performance.
I've been doing all three and just piecing together a living. Yeah.
Let's talk about Zen City. I mean, do you continue to practice Zen, or in writing this book, were you drawing on your past experiences?
I really was drawing on my past experiences because I'm no longer associated with, and haven't been for a long time, with any spiritual institution, Zen included. I mean, once you learn, if you're serious about it, once you learn meditation, whether it's Zen or any other kind, if you're serious about it, though you may drop the forms, the meditation's always there. That zero point is crucial to me. It's important to me every day, every hour. But I no longer chant or cross my legs or wear brown robes or do any of those ritual things that I did when I was member of a Zen center.
What does zero point refer to, actually?
Well, let's see. There's lots of literature about that. Zero point, the place between breathing in and breathing out, the place where you don't identify things as your own, even thoughts as your own, the place outside the parentheses of your particular personality, where you see things with the things themselves, if I may be permitted to be a little poetic.
Well, absolutely. And so it sounds like you've taken from your Zen practice, you perhaps have, you know, moved away from the trappings, the actual affiliation with Zen organization or temple, but it sounds like you've taken away a solid foundation, something you've learned and you apply to this day.
I feel that that's true. Yeah. But the other thing I've taken away, though, is a suspicion, a fear of the institutionalization of those practices. I mean, I understand that it may be necessary. People within the tradition say, well, it's necessary to have a container. Even people who believe that it's necessary to reject forms to really be liberated, to be free inside oneself. People who say that it's necessary to reject forms to be liberated inside oneself nevertheless often say, but you need a container to convey that liberty from across generations, from one person to another. And that's why there are set practices and rituals and chants and uniforms and so on.
Well, let's talk about the book, because it sounds like you deal with some of those things in the book. And
right.
The book is really funny. It's poetic. You play with different writing styles. It's a little hard to capture, but I'm gonna let you give it a shot. Why don't you just tell listeners, you know, a little bit about the story? Just a basic, simple overview, and then we can discuss it more.
You bet. See, the future begins with a traffic jam. I know Jonathan Lethem has written a story that in which life is frozen, city life is frozen in a traffic jam. But I tell you, I wrote this earlier than that. So I guess it's not so hard to imagine looking out at the street that someday the traffic jam could get so intense that things just stop. And so people live in these trashed cars in the world of the book, Zen City, that they refer to as the Red Chevy Motel or the Econoline Van Hotel. And in this world, Zen, enlightenment, is a city. And it becomes a city, an actual physical entity, through two processes, two mirror processes. One is called hypostatization, which is a word I borrowed from theology or philosophy, where to hypostatize means to take an idea and to make a thing out of it, to reify it. So imagine that there were a machine that could hypostatize, that could take ideas from your mind and make them into things, like the old science fiction movie, Forbidden Planet, but a little more abstract than that. And then the opposite, which I call in the book hypodining, which is to take a thing and to make it into an idea, to change it into something abstract. Through a combination of these processes, people are trying to get themselves into this city. Everybody aspires to enter the city. Nobody has a clear idea of what it is, but they all want that. And life outside the city has become really miserable.
Most of your characters live on an exit ramp, I think.
That's right, on the ramp. And the suburbs are strange kind of hybrid places. It's, you know, I think of it as a kind of zone defense in basketball. You know, in basketball, you can have a man-to-man defense where you're defending against some particular person, or you can have a zone defense where you're in charge of a particular area of the court, and whoever enters that zone becomes the one that you're fighting against. Well, in the suburbs, you become whatever zone you enter, so that someone, your mouth might become someone's washing machine, and you find them putting nickels in your nose to do their load of laundry, or you might find your ear trying to suck your nose because your ear has become a baby and your nose is the mother. So as you move through zones in the suburb, you become different things. Your integrity as what you thought of as a person is being changed. So what's being played with throughout this book, Zen City, is the limits of identifying things. I'm trying to deconstruct this perceived reality, the conventional reality that we convince ourselves is the real one, and to get back to the roots of it. I mean, what does a young child experience the world as? To a young child, things aren't things. There's no such thing as things. If you watch a baby's eyes moving around, they don't fix on objects or even on people the way we do. They don't have categories of objects or people yet. And I'm assuming, for the sake of the fiction anyway, that that's more real than the reality of objects and things and people. And these dwellers on the off-ramp who are trying to get into the city have to go through this phase of the dissolution of their conventional ideas of things in order to enter the city.
So is it like making the tenets of Zen and Buddhism, I suppose, and I'm certainly no expert. I mean, I have sat and I actually do try to meditate myself sometimes, and I do sometimes read books about Buddhism, so I think I have a sense of it, but it sounds like you're taking the precepts and making them physically real, like making them part of the fabric of the world of Zen City. It's not an abstract idea that one arrives at just merely sitting on a cushion meditating, but actually in this world, passing through the suburbs and into the city, these things are physically happening to and made tangible, where your ego, your sense of a unique self is evaporating, and you are ultimately, and that seems to be what happens in the city, you merge into a one consciousness where everyone's kind of melting together, and everyone's memories, even the sense of time disappears, past, present, future, becomes kind of this kaleidoscope, mosaic, I don't know, collage.
I think you've nailed it. That's so. I'm not the first one to try this strategy, by the way. Of course, I mean, John Bunyan, was it, who wrote Pilgrim's Progress, used the same technique. He took what is essentially a spiritual journey, and he translated it into a physical journey, so that one goes through a valley of doubt, or Vanity Fair is a phrase that comes from Pilgrim's Progress, and it actually is a fair of vain people. So in Zen City, all these ideas are things, are places, are actual physical circumstances. And the drama plays out with the human aspects of everyone's aspiration, apparently, to become enlightened. Because, you know, you go to a Zen center, or you go to a church or any spiritual group, and no matter what's on the brochure, you bump up against people who have their petty desires. I mean, you know, you go to sit in a Zen center, and I've seen this happen where someone will walk in and up to their brown cushion and find a note on it, a love note from someone else who's a member of the Zen center. So human life does not stop at the doors of the Zendo. It goes on, and there are petty jealousies. I'm more enlightened than that guy. Or in the Zen world, it would be I'm farther along in my koans, my spiritual riddles, than the other guy. And Trungpa, the Tibetan teacher, wrote a book called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. And that's exactly what he was talking about. He was pointing out the fact that you don't leave your human foibles behind when you put on Zen robes.
My favorite characters in the book are the, are they called the Whatiagets?
Yeah, the Whatiagets.
What are they actually? They're discarded thoughts or emotions made physical. I mean, they're sort of grotesque, flying little baby scorpion whatevers. I mean, I guess they take all kinds of shapes, but you know, one is called Tenacity, I guess, because his main attribute is in fact tenacity. But it seems like that. I wasn't sure. Are those the emotions and the sort of the things that people try to discard when one is moving into an enlightened state, and they're sort of hovering around in this cave on the way to the city?
That's right. Well, yes, they're in a cave. They dwell in a cave, a system of grottos and underground tunnels and lost rivers that some people are trying to sneak through on their way to the city. Here's this chamber full of, what do you get? Again, going back to this idea of hypostatting and hypodining, making feelings and thoughts into physical objects and taking physical objects and making them into people and thoughts. In terms of the background of the story that's unfolding in the book, the what he gets are the results of the initial experimentation with this hypostat and hypodyne process, so that you would put together, for example, Weltschmerz and antipathy to large groups and genital crabs, and get some physical creature who embodies those disparate qualities.
Yeah, they're quite a scary lot.
Yeah.
And what do you want the takeaway to be for people? Because it seems kind of like a scary, it's certainly not the way enlightenment, I think, is billed, or at least in sort of passing cultural references, you know, the way it's understood to be this place of deep understanding. I mean, although that's what people are aspiring to, it seems like a much more, how would I describe it? I don't know, unpleasant place where, you know, everyone's, you know, bodily functions and everything's kind of mushed and squished together into one kind of mucousy soup of both nightmare and pleasure, you know? But I don't know if it necessarily seems like a place, once you've seen it, I would want to go there. I guess I should just speak for myself.
No, it's true. The aspiration to be enlightened is certainly a noble quality in human beings. And I think it produces meaning among us in a wonderful way. But it's also corrupted. The minute you start treading the path, you defile it. And also Zen masters, well, of course, have observed that. Whatever a Zen master may be, mind you, one such person said that enlightenment was a nightmare. Another said that enlightenment was a shit stick. Another said that every time I say the word enlightenment, I want to wash my mouth out with soap. And the reason is just that the minute we fix our mind on it, we defile it. We make it something to achieve and something to compare ourselves with others by. So in the book, the nearer people get to the city, the more they see that it's something disgusting, something rotting, because what they're seeing is the detritus of their own psychological shadows. And people convince themselves that they're being spiritual. People convince themselves that they're goal is a spiritual goal, but we don't know what our goals are, and all too often they're revealed to be less than noble. And that's my experience, not only among adherents of Zen and other spiritual practices, but especially among the teachers. I would be more confident of the good character of a storekeeper, of a butcher, than I would be of someone just knowing about them that they were a spiritual teacher. I would be more suspicious of the teacher than I would be of the butcher.
Have you gotten any feedback from people who are of that world that you were once deeply a part of, the Zen world?
Well, there are those who have a sense of humor, and there are those who have not, and they react accordingly. Some people are and will be, I'm sure, very offended by the suggestion that there might be something dark about a spiritual tradition. And there are those, as I mentioned, those acknowledged Zen, quote, masters, unquote, who have said essentially the same thing that I'm saying in this book, that there is a shadow that Lao Tzu says that the world is something so sacred, so fundamentally sacred, that it's defiled by the slightest touch. And that's really the core of what Zen City is about. Although, because I'm a comedian, it's a comic book as well.
Do you feel it's also a message just generally about religion, that the journey that people put themselves on as they aspire, if they are, you know, devoted to a doctrine and are particularly doctrinaire, that if you were to take those teachings literally, it might, and to, as you have done, you know, really create a world where this becomes literally and physically true, it reaches, there's some kind of absurd endpoint?
Well, the Kama Sutra is this old Hindu book by a guy named Vatsyayana, and it's the art of love. And in it, he has all these formulas for achieving union with the beloved. For example, you see a man sees a woman whom he likes, and one of the techniques that Vatsyayana suggests is to admire the woman's dog, to get into a conversation. And he has more specific suggestions for every phase of the relationship, the lovemaking, getting into bed with the beloved, unclothing the beloved. And then he says in this book, the Kama Sutra, you will come to a certain point when passion takes over, and then you have to give up all the rules. You have to jettison the rules. It's the same, I think, that Wittgenstein says at the end of his book, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, this famous book in Western philosophy. He says it toward the end of that book, you climb this rope ladder up into a bunk, and then you don't leave the ladder hanging. You have to roll it up after you. But what happens in spiritual traditions like Zen or Catholicism or any number of others that you can mention where there are robes and rules and holy books is that people begin to value the rope ladder more than they value the bunk. They want their robes, they want their rituals, they want their status in the organization. And as for enlightenment, well, that just becomes a sign of status. Whereas enlightenment, as we all understood it at the beginning when we were drawn toward it, is something that has no outward signs, that entitles one to no status. In fact, the Zen guy Hakuin, I think, always referred to the true man of no status, the true man of no status. That was his idea of an enlightened person, a person of no status. But you go into a Zen center and try to find one of those. No, you're more likely to find one in a butcher shop.
Tell me how you have integrated these two parts of yourself. One part of you is a performance artist who, I imagine, in order to have the stamina, willingness, courage to stand on a stage, interact with an audience, requires a certain amount of ego and in your face, you know, bravado. And then there's this other part of you that's a writer who, in my experience as a writer, likes to be kind of by himself and needs time alone and anonymously working away at your laptop, I imagine.
Yeah, it's true. You describe it very well. It's funny. Lonely. I mean, writing is a very solitary pursuit, and performance is just the opposite of that. I'm damned if I can answer that question. I love them both. I love the communion of performance. My favorite moments on stage are the moments where the audience and I know are experiencing something exactly the same way at the same moment. And I know it because of this feeling of silence or the sensation of laughter. One can feel that one-pointedness is just wonderful. And I thank Zen training, by the way, for allowing me to find that more surely. because it requires a kind of emptying out on stage. You have to empty yourself out and become almost a projection of the audience. As to writing, I mean, well, you're a writer and you know this the same way I do, what pleasure there is, what euphoria there is in surrendering yourself to the writing. Well, rewriting we can talk about another time, but the initial flow of writing is just, it's just wonderful.
It's interesting, though, because in a performance, I imagine you do the same thing over and over again, and you get to relive right. it. But writing, you know, when you finally get it right and it's done, you're kind of letting it go.
You're right. You're right. That's a damn good question. That would be a good subject of an essay or a meditation or a book. The difference between performance and writing.
What's your show like, actually? Give a sense of what, I mean, I guess you've done many different kinds of shows, and it's often for, is it for kids? It's for young people, usually?
My bread and butter has been performance for young people, but every couple of years, I do a show for adult audiences. The most recent show I did was not really my own, but one, you know, Wally Shawn's piece, The Fever?
Yeah.
It's a great monologue in which, among other things, you get to tell people about some of the concepts of Marx's Capital. But I did that. It's a monologue of about an hour and a half for audiences all over the San Francisco Bay Area. More typically, I would do pieces that I made myself. I've done shows of the poetry of Baudelaire with music on the theremin. I've done Whitman. I once did, for my solo show of that year, the entire book of Revelation in the King James translation from beginning to end, God help us.
Wow, okay.
And bits of that are on YouTube.
That sounds good. But tell me a little bit about the journey to publication for Zen City. You ended up at Zero Books, and Douglas Lane, he was a previous guest on the
right.
show. For his book, which I have right here, After the Saucers Landed. But how did you end up there? I know he publishes largely, I think, a lot of nonfiction, you know, critiques of capitalism and books about art and philosophy and that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, yeah, Douglas, like you and me, is a science fiction writer. I'm a fan. And he let out the word, I can't remember exactly how, maybe it was through an email blast or on a website, that Zero Books was looking to expand into fictional works that had to do with epistemology. And, you know, I've always been very interested in epistemology in fiction. I wrote an essay once, a long time ago, for the New York Review of Science Fiction about epistemological fiction. And when Doug put out this word, I had, as a matter of fact, in my infamous trunk, you know about these trunks, with unpublishable material.
Absolutely, yeah. Mm.
The novel Zen City. Zen City, which is a piece of epistemological fiction. It's about how we know things, and especially about that moment between seeing a thing and knowing what it is, that wonderful moment. A pregnant moment, that's really the place of origin of Zen City. So I sent him the book, and he said yes. Always an amazing and unexpected thing for a writer to hear.
Absolutely. Well, it's amazing to hear anyone putting out a call for fiction books about epistemology.
It was very lucky. I don't know if you know of, there was a monologist. How do you say that word? A monologue deliverer named Shelley Berman in the 1950s, and he used to make fun of the University of Chicago by holding up a glass of water and saying, "This is a glass of water, but is this a glass of water? And if it is a glass of water, why is it a glass of water?" The audience would howl, but there you have it. That's epistemology.
Where's your head at right now? Is it working on another short story or a book, or is it on your next performance?
Well, right now, as I I mentioned to you earlier, I'm up to my elbows in clay and plaster. I'm making masks. I want to explore mask work some more. And there's some people in theater people around Santa Rosa where I live who are interested in doing it with me. So I'm excited to get started in that. As to writing, my next project, I think, and performance will have to do with the Dybbuk, the legend of the Dybbuk, written first in Russian and then in Yiddish by a guy named Anski, though I think that's really a made-up name. When I was little, I grew up among Yiddish-speaking immigrants and absorbed enough to be able to piece my way through the Dybbuk anyway in Yiddish. And I think it'll be an exciting piece.
Wow, fantastic. Well, something to look forward to. Thank you so much, Elliot, for speaking to me.
Oh, it's been really great. And especially since you're a writer, too. And so you know exactly where the points I'm making go.
Yeah, I always enjoy so much hearing about other people's process. And just, you know, it's just so much fun to discuss, you know, a wonderful story that you've clearly put so much into.
Well, thanks, Rob. It's been a great pleasure.
I've been speaking with Elliot Fintichel, author of Zen City, out this year from Zero Books. So I encourage everyone to get their own copy of it. I am Rob Wolf, your host for this New Books in Science Fiction podcast. Podcast logo is designed by Michael Thibodeau. Our music is by Michael Aaron. And the editor of the entire New Books Network, which has lots of podcasts out there, is Marshall Poe. If you haven't yet, check out my books, The Alternate Universe and The Escape. And you can follow me on Twitter at Rob Wolf Books. You can follow the podcast at New Books Sci-Fi. And we also have a Facebook page. And follow us also on iTunes and leave a review. That would be great if you did that. It helps other people find the podcast. So thank you very much for listening.